Here we are again with Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. With me, I suppose I'm your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson, inviting you to attend and to respond, if you'd like, by email to rla@momentsunderlamplight.com or on the archives page at momentsunderlamplight.com. Last time we were talking about I-it and I-thou relationships, and we'll follow that this time with a related theme, exchange. Me and you, I and I, what's yours is mine and what's mine is yours. Some bits of our show will be a revised version, a kind of second edition of a show first broadcast in the summer of 2009. We're given this material a long enough time to mature. It's time to exchange once again some of the things we did back then. The first aspect of exchange I want to share this evening under lamplight is correspondence, in the sense, first of all, of letters passing between people. So let's look at a song called simply The Letter. No, not the Box Tops or Joe Cocker, but the Incredible String Band. Not one of their best-known songs, and not one of their deepest. It's one of Mike Herron's little pieces of whimsy. Charming, we might say. Playful, uplifting, teasing us with potential sentimentality, but then deftly avoiding it. It's a kind of obad, a medieval verse form in which the lover sings to his lady first thing in the morning. Only there's a difference here. First of all, it's the postman who takes the first step, not the lover. He's bringing the letters early in the morning, causing Mike to get out of bed. Too much, I've got a letter. Better get out of bed. Do you remember Too Much? A universal but mindless hippie expression of grateful joy. Here, have some apple pie. Hey, too much, man. Oh, but wait. It might not be a letter for Mike, but for his girlfriend Rose, whose mother writes very regularly. But now Mr. Postman announces that, yes, he has a letter for Mike, and then our second too much. Too much, I've got a letter, and I said it with some joy. It comes from Maria, Chicago, Illinois. You see, that's what keeps it from being sentimental. Sentimentality is always earnest. And so the moment we become playful, we break that sickly sentimental spell. Imagine rhyming joy with Illinois. Completely unexpected. And apparently complete opposites, because Mike Herron then slurs Chicago. He's never met Maria, but she sounds sweet like a flower that grows on a rubbish heap. Presumably that rubbish heap is Chicago, though it might also refer to the Nixon regime and the Vietnam War. Apparently, Maria spoke in her letter about a lot of problems she was facing, but she must have written in such a way that the message was not one of woe, but of joy. Maria, the plane that brought your letter, must have felt a little bit lighter, and the air hostess must have felt brighter, bringing your letter over the sea. The pilot must have been her Orpheus, he says, that beautiful mythic singer. And Mike is going to be her Orpheus too, singing her this song in exchange for the letter she sent him. But by the time she hears this song, her troubles will be gone. And here's Mike Herron's delicate sweetness. It sort of makes up for the fluffiness of the rest of the song. He says, "You'll be left with what's shining through the letter. You. Troubles pass away, but you, your essential, beautiful self that permeates the letter, that remains forever. You exchange all your troubles for your true self in the end." The song is not in the Incredible String Band's Eastern-influenced or psychedelic style, but more of a folk rock style, with Dave Maddox, the drummer from Fairport Convention, giving us his playful extravaganza under the voice and guitars. And don't forget to attend to the exchange between Mike Herron's voice and the instruments, weaving back and forth to produce the full effect of the song. Mm-hmm.
started rubbing my eyes when I heard the birds talk. Said, hey, Mr. Sleep, you're gonna have to take a walk, 'cause nothing has much power to make me rise as the postman bringing the morning surprise. Here it comes. You better believe me, here it comes. Too much I've got a ladder, better get out. Then I pulled the covers right up to my nose. I thought, well, a letter might be for Rose. Her mother, she writes very regularly. Mr. Postman, have you got a letter for me? Mr. Heron? Yes, I have. Says right here, yes, I have. Too much I've got a letter, and I said it with some joy. It came from Maria, Chicago, Illinois. And I never have met her, but she sounds sweet like a flower growing on the rubbish heap. She got a lot of things, oh, she gotta work out, but she's gonna make it, have no doubt. Neither is she. Oh no. Must have felt a little bit lighter. And the air hostess must have felt brighter, bringing your letter over the sea. The pilot was your Orpheus, singing a song for you. Marie, I'm singing, hell, I'm singing now. Be your Orpheus.
There was the incredible string band with The Letter, a bit of playfulness from the 1970 album I Looked Up. And now to an older letter, in fact 294 years old. It's one of the essays from Samuel Johnson's series of bi-weekly essays called The Rambler, which Johnson wrote between the years 1750 and 1752. Sometimes he addressed tough moral issues, sometimes gave wise advice, but always with his special compassionate irony towards the weaknesses and failings of our common human nature. The 101st Rambler from Tuesday, March 5th, 1751, took the form of a letter, a piece of correspondence, sent in to Johnson, though it's obvious to any reader that this was just Johnson writing in a different form. No real correspondence in that sense, after all. The letter is from someone who calls himself Hilarious. He's a funny guy. People admire him for his wit. Here's what he says. When he was at university, and in those days there were only Cambridge and Oxford in England, he diligently studied the best ideas and moral principles and the true sign of a liberal education. He practiced how to apply these ideas and principles to life. But he felt he was wasting his talents at university. I considered myself as a gem hidden in the mine, he says, and so he set out for London to mingle in the crowd of public life. In London, he was a great success. I was naturally attracted, he says, by the company of those who were of the same age with myself, and finding that my academic gravity contributed very little to my reputation, I applied my faculties to jocularity and burlesque. In other words, He threw off academic seriousness and took up jokes and satiric imitations of others, the kind of stand-up we see all around these days. But his performances would not have been on stage, but at dinner tables and in coffee houses. He applied himself so well to this and was so talented at it that he soon excelled all others. "I became on a sudden the idol of the coffee house," he says. Everyone wanted him to go to each new play so they could hear his sharp, witty opinions about the play. "Oh, hilarious," we can picture them saying. "You must come with us to the opening night and tell us what you think about it." Or, rather, tell us what we should think about it. No discussion about the merits of a new play was complete without his views on the subject. He became an 18th century celebrity. Everywhere he was surrounded by an avid audience who caught his maxims and jests and spread them around wherever they went. "I was just talking to my good friend Hilarious, don't you know, and here's what he was saying about the new play." Even those who had only drank chocolate in the same room as Hilarious claimed they were one of his intimate friends. Notice that Hilarious has done nothing wrong. He's just applied his native talent to give the people what they want. He's done nothing worse than rise to the top of the ego game. He knows that being admired for your conversational skill provides you with an instant response from your audience. Unlike the situation of a writer, here is a quick exchange. You make a witty comment, and immediately you can see people's laughter, which is the best praise. And there's a special thrill to the ego in entering a room to find the people there suddenly, as Hilarious puts it, suddenly brightened with gladness and hushed with expectation. That's the general situation. Now we move into a specific incident. There was one of Hilarious's fans called Democrates. Democrates is rich, and Hilarious, not particularly rich himself, enjoys the fine meals and luxurious surroundings Democrates invites him to. It's a fair exchange. Hilarious offers great conversation, and Democrates offers luxury and also a good selection of dinner guests to partake in the sharp conversation. "But," Hilarious says, and we're always on the alert for Samuel Johnson's buts. Every human life has its buts. "But," he says, "all power has its sphere of activity beyond which it produces no effect. Like all great human achievements, there is a limit to their scope, and to go too far with them, and then things will collapse." Hilarious is a great success in the witty circles of London, but what happens outside this sphere of activity? Well, here's what happened. Democrates had to go off to his country estate, and he brought Hilarious along with him to impress his country neighbours. It was a fair exchange. Again, Hilarious was perfectly aware that he was enjoying the luxurious, stately home so that he could impress the country friends. And so Democrates invites all the best people in the rural neighborhood to a big dinner, telling them all that he has the famous Hilarious with him, building up for them how exciting the dinner conversation is going to be with such a celebrity in their midst. Can you imagine inviting all your friends around to dinner where your good pal Rory Bremner or Stephen Fry is also going to show up? That's what Johnson is describing here. The day of the big dinner arrives, and the guests show up and are introduced to Hilarious. They wait to see him be funny, but that's all they do. Wait. There's no relaxed conversation, just these tense country people sitting there expecting to be entertained. And Hilarious can find nothing to say. His wit is not spontaneous. It needs something to play off of. It must be part of an exchange in the midst of a good conversation or after an evening at the theatre. "I had waited in hope of some opportunity to divert them," says poor Hilarious, "but I could find no pass opened for a single sally. And who can be merry without an object of mirth?" And so all the country friends go home, gravely disappointed. Some of them think Democrates has been deluded by this phony wit from London. Others think that Hilarious is too stuck up to put himself out for mere country people. Of course, neither is the true case, but these people haven't the penetration to see that. And Hilarious offers some advice at the end of his letter. The ability to be funny, he says, is not wholly at the command of its possessor. If the audience are too anxious to be amused, they simply won't be receptive to what their entertainer has to offer. If they expect humor, then they're less likely to be surprised, and surprise is necessary to gaiety. But most of all, as he puts it, those who desire to partake at the pleasure of wit must contribute to its production. In other words, we need that exchange. If we all sit around in agreement, where can there be any wit? We need some opposition, some heckler, perhaps, for the wit to work off of. Ask any performer. The quality of the performance depends on the quality of the audience. Like every other kind of social interaction, it must work through exchange. Now, here's the same problem in a slightly different situation. The private buffoon, the comedian hired by rich people to keep them and their guests amused. All the time. No matter what the comedian feels, he must always be funny. As we hear from this Gilbert and Sullivan song from Yeoman of the Guard.
Oh, a private buffoon is a light-hearted loon if you listen to popular rumor. From the morn to the night, he's so joyous and bright, and he babbles with wit and good humor. He's so quaint and so terse, both in prose and in verse, yet though people forgive his transgression, there are one or two rules that all family fools must observe if they love their profession. There are one or two rules, half a dozen maybe, that all family fools of whatever degree must observe if they love their profession. If you wish to succeed as a jester, you need to consider each person's auricula. What is all right for B would quite scandalize C, for C is so very particular. And D may be dull, and E's very thick skull is as empty of brains as a ladle. While F is F sharp, and will cry with a carp that he's known your best joke from his cradle. When you humor they flout, you can't let yourself go, and it does put you out when a person says, oh, I have known that old joke from my cradle. If your master is surly from getting up early and tempers are short in the morning, an inopportune joke is enough to provoke him to give you at once a month's warning. Then if you refrain, he is at you again, for he likes to get value for money. He'll ask then and there with an insolent stare if you know that you're paid to be funny. It adds to the task of a merriman's place when your principal asks with a scowl on his face if you know that you're paid to be funny. Comes a bishop, maybe you're a solemn DD. Oh, beware of his anger provoking. Better not pull his hair, don't stick pins in his chair. He don't understand practical joking. If the jest that you crack have an orthodox smack, you may get a bland smile from these sages. But should it by chance be imported from France, half a crown is stopped out of your wages. It's a general rule, or your zeal it may quench. If the family fool tells a joke that's too French, half a crown is stopped out of his wages. Though your head it may rack with a bilious attack, and your senses with toothache you're losing, don't be mopey and flat, they don't fine you for that if you're properly quaint and amusing. Though your wife ran away with a soldier that day and took with her your trifle of money, bless your heart, they don't mind, they're exceedingly kind. They don't blame you as long as you're funny. It's a comfort to feel though your partner should fit. Though you suffer a deal, they don't mind it a bit. They don't blame you so long as you're funny.
That was Gerrit Evans with the Dolly Cart and Oh, a Private Buffoon. And this is Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. We're talking about different kinds of exchanges. And now it's time for another in our occasional lessons in Latin that I know everyone loves to hear. There's a Latin phrase that comes in handy when we speak about exchanges. Do ut des. D-O, U-T, D-E-S. It means, I give so that you give, or more loosely, I give to you so that you will give back to me. Here's what exchange means to many people. It's a deal, a trade-off. I give you something in the expectation that you will give me something back. There is a fair balance in the end, we hope, but there seems something a little self-serving here. I don't give because I want to give something nice to you. I give so that I'll get something nice myself. I'm looking after myself and not giving anything away for free. It's an I-it exchange. You're just an it that I'm working on in order to get something for myself. There's another version of this phrase, though, that brings us closer to I-thou. It is do et des, E-T, rather than U-T, and that makes all the difference. Do et des means I give and may you give. In my giving, I allow you the chance to give also. I set up a generous action and invite you to share it with me. Thus, we're both doing things freely, for love rather than for obligation. Our focus is on the other, not on creating an even score. Or sometimes it gets more complicated. Sometimes it's easy to give to others. The hard part is to take from others. There's a surrender at such moments. We stop being active, in control, and take on the passive role of the receiver. Do we dare allow ourselves to be so vulnerable? And here Bob Dylan's line comes back to my mind. May you always do for others, and let others do for you. I'll say it again. May you always do for others, and let others do for you. I and I. And we're going to move on to a French children's song, which is also about exchange. It's sung by Anne Sylvestre, with the accompaniment of a group of children whom she has obviously charmed, and who have charmed her in turn. An exchange. The song is called Bel Escalier. It takes the form of a cycle of questions and answers as Anne climbs one step at a time of a beautiful staircase, the Bel Escalier, one step after another, asking permission to climb to the next step. At each step, however, she has to pay something. Que dois-je vous donner? What should I give you? Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez. Give whatever you'd like. It's the same routine at each step, with the variation coming in what she can afford to offer, or what she has on hand that she can give. And for everything she gives, the children give something to her in return. At the first step, she says she has only her handkerchief, but she needs it in case she weeps. Oh, that's okay, give your handkerchief, one of the girls tells her. You'll never cry anymore. At the second step, she says she has only her barrette, or hair grip, and without it, her hair will fall down. That's okay, says another girl. I will do your hair back up for you. Je vous recoifferai. At the third step, she says she has only her sandals, which she needs for walking. Don't worry, says another girl. You can give up your sandals. We've swept the place clean here. At the fourth step, she says she has only 3 marbles. The others have broken. Give your marbles, says another girl. We love to play marbles. At the fifth step, she says she has only her jumping rope. But I love to skip rope. Give us your rope, says another girl, and I'll lend it back to you. At the sixth step, she says she knows a story she can tell them. Oh, yes, says another girl. Tell us your story. We love to dream. At the seventh step, she says she has only her smile, which she is quite willing to give them. Ah, says another girl, keep your smile. We don't need that. Ici, tout le monde est gay. Here, everyone is happy. At the final step, she says she has only her heart. After that, she has nothing more. Then give your heart, says another girl, and we will love you well. It won't be too hard to follow along with the French, which is sung slowly and clearly, and actually is much simpler than the more elaborate translation I just gave you. So let's hear Bel Escalier.
Bel escalier, puis-je monter?
Mais oui, madame, il faut payer.
À la première marche, que dois-je vous donner?
Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez.
Je n'ai que mon mouchoir, me le faut pour pleurer.
Donnez votre mouchoir, plus jamais pleurerai.
Bel escalier, puis-je monter?
Mais oui, madame, il faut payer.
À la deuxième marche, que dois-je vous donner?
Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez.
Je n'ai que ma barrette, mes cheveux vont tomber.
Donnez votre barrette, je vous recoifferai.
Escalier, puis-je monter?
Mais oui, madame, il faut payer.
À la troisième marche, que dois-je vous donner?
Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez.
Je n'ai que mes sandales, me les faut pour marcher.
Donnez donc vos sandales, nous avons balayé.
Bel escalier, puis-je monter?
Mais oui, madame, il faut payer.
À la quatrième marche, que dois-je vous donner?
Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez.
Je n'ai plus que trois billes, les autres sont cassées.
Donnez donc vos trois billes, nous aimons y jouer.
Bel escalier, puis-je monter?
Mais oui, madame, il faut payer.
À la cinquième marche, que dois-je vous donner?
Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez.
Je n'ai plus que ma corde, mais j'aime bien sauter.
Donnez donc votre corde, je vous la prêterai.
Escalier, puis-je monter?
Mais oui, madame, il faut payer.
À la sixième marche, que dois-je vous donner?
Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez.
Je connais une histoire, je peux la raconter.
Racontez votre histoire, nous aimons bien rêver.
Escalier, puis-je monter?
Mais oui, madame, il faut payer.
À la septième marche, que dois-je vous donner?
Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez.
Je n'ai que mon sourire, je vous le donnerai.
Gardez votre sourire, ici tout le monde est gai.
Bel escalier, puis-je monter?
Mais oui, madame, il faut payer.
À la dernière marche, que dois-je vous donner?
Donnez, donnez, madame, tout ce que vous voudrez.
Je n'ai plus que mon cœur, après je n'ai plus rien.
Donnez donc votre cœur, nous vous aimerons bien.
How's that for an odd sort of late night radio music? Evening under lamplight, you never know what's next, except it won't be your usual late night radio fare. And that was Anne Silvestre singing Bel Escalier from her album Les Nouvelles Fabulettes, the new little fables, new little stories. The kingdom of heaven is like someone climbing a magical staircase and offering all she has and being given everything she needs and wants in exchange. And from fabulette to fairy tale, specifically to Irish fairy gold. You know what that is? Well, someday you might find yourself wandering around in a deep forest, and you might come across a fairy who, if you're lucky, will give you a bag filled with gold coins. It is yours to keep, but there is one stipulation. The bag will stay filled with gold only if you keep giving the gold coins away. Yes, a true exchange, never ending. And here is a delightful, loving song about such exchanges, written by John Sebastian in his prime, sung by the Loving Spoonful, called Full Measure. It's a wonderful, warm-hearted song with that all-important, unsentimental, playful sparkle. The Loving Spoonful and Full Measure. And here is an excerpt from a poem in Luke's Gospel that shows what Jesus had to say about the kind of full measure the Loving Spoonful were speaking about. Did you ever hear of Jesus the poet? All he did was speak in poetry. Here's one of his little poems. Give, and it shall be given unto you. Good measure, pressed down and shaken together and running over, shall men give into your bosom. For with the same measure that ye meet withal, it shall be measured to you again. There you go. The classic statement of this just exchange. For with the same measure that you give out, it shall be measured to you again. Or as it was sung to us back in 1969... There we are. But now we move ever so smoothly over to Shakespeare, whose troublesome play Measure for Measure is based on the themes of just and unjust exchanges. For instance, and this story is a great story, so I hope you'll enjoy what's going on with these characters. The puritanical Angelo has the hearts for Isabella, an intense, idealistic young woman whose only desire is to become a nun with the strictest order. When Isabella comes pleading to Angelo to save her brother, who's been condemned to death just for having had sex with his fiancée, Angelo proposes an exchange. You come to bed with me, Isabella, and I'll release your brother. She leaves to visit her brother Claudio in prison and tell him about Angelo's exchange. Oh, wonderful, says Claudio. Thank you so much for doing this to save my life. What, she says, with all the passion of an adolescent committed to our holy cause. What? Are you really saying you want me to go to bed with that man just in order to save your life? But then there's the Duke, who's working behind the scenes. There's something strange about his motives, but that needn't concern us here. He butts in and proposes an alteration to the exchange. Instead of Isabella, Angelo should go to bed with Mariana, the woman he had been engaged to but has been ignoring for some time. Going to bed would officially consummate their marriage, which is what Mariana desires, though it's hard to see why she wants to be married to a man like Angelo, but never mind. This is not the exchange Angelo had anticipated, but certainly a fairer exchange. It's dark, and he doesn't notice that the woman he's with is not Isabella, and all seems well until Angelo, the next morning, reneges on his part of the exchange and refuses to set Claudio free. Yes, it's a nasty play, but all comes out well in the end, thanks to the Duke, who readjusts all the measures and brings justice. Sort of. The Duke announces quite suddenly at the very end that he'll marry Isabella. Shakespeare gives Isabella no lines at this point. Each production can do what it chooses. Usually we see her pleased to marry this rich, powerful man, but in one famous production, Isabella turned to the Duke in astonishment and, still not speaking any lines, slaps him hard in the face and storms off stage. That's her exchange. We may have moved over to the Taming of the Shrew, but I doubt it. The Duke's do ut des attitude here, I'll do something good for you, and then I'll expect some kind of favors back from you. It's the old game that's played in many different ways. The boy puts out some money for the date, expecting in exchange for the girl to put out, as we would say on the streets of Philadelphia. I put out, you put out, baby. In the next song, it's not quite so crude, but crude enough. It's a song that came out in 1950 in the Broadway musical Guys and Dolls, expressing what happens when the rich guy showers gifts on his doll, expecting something back in exchange, but the doll is pure, or shall we say innocent, or shall we say naive. She's been under the impression that he'd given her these things just because he liked her. The exchange she's really looking for is the exchange at the altar. I do. Only the marriage proposal is gift enough for her to exchange. But after giving her a mink and a gown, the necklace, the shoes, and the hat in late 48, as I recall, one night in his apartment he tried to remove them all, and he got an exchange all right. Take back your mink, she told him. Take back your pearls. What makes you think that I'm that kind of a girl? The song is not part of the actual drama of Guys and Dolls. It's a review song sung by Adelaide, one of the characters, and it's not quite so innocent after all. As she sings it, she takes off the clothes to give back to him and so turns the song into a kind of striptease act with Adelaide and her backup chorus, the Hot Box Girls, ending up performing in corsets and stockings. The role of Adelaide was a secondary role in Guys and Dolls, but Vivian Blaine, great Vivian Blaine, made it one of the wonderful Broadway characters of all time, with her New York accent and her vulnerable but true-hearted voice. The music and lyrics were written by Frank Lesser. Here's Adelaide with Take Back Your Mink.
He bought me the fur coat 5 winters ago and the gown the following fall. Then the necklace, the bag, the hat, and the shoes. That was late 48, I recall. Then last night in his apartment, he tried to remove them all. And I said, as I ran down the hall, take back your mink, take back your pails. What made you think that I was one of those gales? Take back the gown, the shoes, and the hat. I may be down, but I'm not flat as all that. I thought that each expensive gift you'd arranged was a token of your esteem. Now when I think of what you want in exchange, it all seems a horrible dream. So take back your mink to from whence it came and tell him to Hollanderize it for some other
Take back your mink to from whence it came and tell them to Hollanderize it for some other dame. A great phrase, Hollanderize it. But what does it mean? We can guess that it means something like dry clean it. Here's your mink coat back. Get it dry cleaned for your next victim. But a little research shows that it's more complex and wittier than we supposed. In the 1940s and 50s, Hollanderizing was a method of dyeing the cheaper, plebeian, but widely worn muskrat coats so that they looked like real mink coats. So what Adelaide is saying is that her coat is not mink in the first place, but muskrat. Keep that in mind next time your doll hands back the muskrat you gave her. So much for all these different kinds of exchange, and we haven't even attended to the most common area of exchange, money. It would be good to see how Dante portrays the usurers, people who make money out of money, as though money was a commodity rather than just a means of exchange. But no, there's not really enough time to go into this tonight, maybe another time. Because now it's time to move on to our passage from Walt Whitman, which also highlights exchanges. Here's the 22nd chant of Song of Myself. I'll read it to get us started, and then we'll talk further. Whitman is addressing the sea, S-E-A. You see, I resign myself to you also. I guess what you mean. I behold from the beach your crooked, inviting fingers. I believe you refuse to go back with that feeling of me. We must have a turn together. I undress, hurry me out of sight of the land, cushion me soft, rock me in billowy drowse, dash me with amorous wet, I can repay you. sea of stretched ground swells, sea breathing broad and convulsive breaths, sea of the brine of life, sea of unshoveled and always ready graves. Howler and scooper of storms, capricious and dainty sea, I am integral with you. I too am of one phase and of all phases. Partaker of influx and efflux, extoller of hate and conciliation, extoller of amis and those that sleep in each other's arms. I am he attesting sympathy. Shall I make my list of things in the house and skip the house that supports them? I am the poet of common sense, and of the demonstrable, and of immortality, and am not the poet of goodness only. I do not decline to be the poet of wickedness also. Washes and razors for foo-foos, for me, freckles and a bristling beard. What blurt is it about virtue and about vice? Evil propels me, and reform of evil propels me. I stand indifferent. My gate is no fault-finder's or rejecter's gate. I moisten the roots of all that has grown. Did you fear some scrofula out of the unflagging pregnancy? Did you guess the celestial laws are yet to be worked over and rectified? I step up to say that what we do is right, and what we affirm is right, and some is only the ore of right. Witnesses of us, one side a balance and the antipodal side a balance, soft doctrine as steady help as stable doctrine, thoughts and deeds of the present are rouse and early start. This minute that comes to me over the past decillions, there is no better than it and now. What behaved well in the past or behaves well today is not such a wonder. The wonder is always and always how there can be a mean man or an infidel. I don't know if you can hear this, but there's an awful noise outside, like a helicopter hovering around. Maybe they heard something I said and have come to investigate. In any case, excuse me a second, I'll close the window. You've just been listening to a radio show where the window is closed on air live. Not many shows do that. Back to Walt Whitman. That was pretty hard going. I don't expect you really caught much of that poem. But we have to start somewhere. Let's see if I can help bring it to some clarity and some life for us. I'm always humbled by what A.B. said when he was in the studio a few times ago when I read the Whitman and he said he didn't get any of it. But after I explained it and he said, I got it. Not all of it, some of it. I don't even get the whole thing myself. That's okay. In the section before this, you may recall what we discussed in the last show, Whitman ended up embracing, in erotic terms, the bare-bosomed night, pressing close to her, and next to the voluptuous, cool-breathed earth. Now it's the turn of the sea, which, or who, seduces him to enter her and lose himself in the embrace. I behold from the beach your crooked, inviting fingers. Those are the waves. They come into the shore and pull back, like crooked, inviting fingers, refusing to go back without the feeling of me. And he doesn't hold back, but jumps into the embrace. We must have a turn together. I undress. Hurry me out of the sight of the land. Cushion me soft. Rock me in billowy drowse. Dash me with amorous wet. I can repay you. You see the exchange here. You have a turn together, but first you have to undress, take off your costume, the outer self you wear to everyone else, and come to the embrace as unaccommodated man, as King Lear says. In fact, the sea seems to be characterized by exchange. The stretched ground swells up and down, broad and convulsive breaths in and out, and a more macabre exchange. The sea is the brine of life. It gives life, but it also takes life as we are reminded by the image of unshoveled and always ready graves. No one has to dig the graves of those who have drowned. The sea covers them itself, always ready. Whitman accepts this give and take of the sea and is with you, a partaker of influx and efflux, extoller of hate and conciliation, extoller of amis, those are friends, and those that sleep in each other's arms, and those are lovers. The influx and efflux of the sea has become an image of all exchange, and in particular the exchange of extremes, hatred and reconciliation, common sense and immortality. We seem to have shifted away from the erotic sea imagery now to attend to the extremes of moral behavior. Whitman says he is the poet not just of goodness, but of wickedness also. What blurt is it, blurt, what a great word there. What blurt is it about virtue and about vice? What's all that fuss? Evil propels me, and reform of evil propels me. I stand indifferent. My gate is no fault finder's or rejecter's gate. I suppose if we're going to enter fully into the spirit of exchange, we must not adopt the rejecter's gate. We mustn't find fault with what is offered. We must accept what comes for what it is, and then offer back what is right to offer back, perhaps just a smile or thanks of appreciation. This, it seems, is the only way to live in the present moment, and to accept that this present moment is as wonderful as every other minute of all the decillions of moments in the past. A decillion is 10 times a million. That is, 1 followed by 60 zeros. That's a long time. And here's the climactic moment. The true wonder comes not from all the wonderful things that we experience in the moment, wonderful enough as they are, but in the astonishing fact that despite all this exuberant joy found in this dance of exchange, there should still be anyone who doubts or rejects this. What behaved well in the past or behaves well today is not such a wonder. The wonder is always and always how there can be a mean man or an infidel. And as usual, we don't want to end right there, but we want to re-experience the passage in its entirety now that we have a little clearer sense of what's there. So I'll read it one more time. We'll go out to a few minutes anyway of Beethoven's string quartet, which I think captures the mood of that last line of the passage. You see, I resign myself to you also. I guess what you mean. I behold from the beach your crooked, inviting fingers. I believe you refuse to go back without feeling of me. We must have a turn together. I undress. Hurry me out of sight of the land. Cushion me soft. Rock me in billowy drowse. Dash me with amorous wet. I can repay you. Sea of stretched ground swells, sea breathing broad and convulsive breaths, sea of the brine of life, sea of unshoveled and always ready graves, howler and scooper of storms, capricious and dainty sea. I am integral with you. I too am of one phase and of all phases, partaker of influx and efflux, extoller of hate and conciliation, extoller of amis and those that sleep in each other's arms. I am here testing sympathy. Shall I make my list of things in the house and skip the house that supports them? I am the poet of common sense and of the demonstrable and of immortality, and am not the poet of goodness only. I do not decline to be the poet of wickedness also. Washes and razors for foo-foos. For me, freckles and a bristling beard. What blurt is it about virtue and about vice? Evil propels me, and reform of evil propels me. I stand indifferent. My gate is no fault-finder's or rejecter's gate. I moisten the roots of all that has grown. Did you fear some scrofula out of the unflagging pregnancy? Did you guess the celestial laws are yet to be worked over and rectified? I step up to say that what we do is right and what we affirm is right, and some is only the ore of right. Witnesses of us. One side a balance and the antipodal side a balance. Soft doctrine as steady help as stable doctrine. Thoughts and deeds of the present arouse and early start. This minute that comes to me over the past decillions, there is no better than it and now. What behaved well in the past or behaves well today is not such a wonder. The wonder is always and always how there can be a mean man or an infidel. There's some nervous Beethoven strings from the string quartet number 9, Tokyo Quartet. And I'll say goodnight from Evening Under Lamplight. It's Robert Louis Abramson on Cambridge 105. See you next time.
Thank you.